From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! An Iraqi-American doctor will talk to us about the effects of the UN embargo on Iraq. We'll also talk to Congressmember John Conyers about police brutality. He's holding hearings in New York tomorrow. We'll speak with him and former presidential candidate Ron Daniels as well about why Emmanuel Constant, the leader of the Haitian paramilitary death squad FRAP, has not yet been extradited to Haiti. And a look at the study on stalking. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Saudi Arabia, after discussions with Secretary of State Madeleine Albright, has called today for a diplomatic solution to the Persian Gulf crisis while reserving judgment on the use of military force. A Saudi statement called Albright's talks warm, positive, and productive, and appeared to embrace the American position on the UN Security Council confrontation with Iraq. A senior Saudi official who briefed reporters on the discussion said he was not unhappy with diplomatic discussions underway to resolve the crisis, but he refused to elaborate. In Baghdad, Iraqi leader Saddam Hussein says he doesn't seek armed conflict over the inspection issue and praised Arab countries that have opposed use of the military. At Fort Benning, Georgia, nearly 600 protesters attempting to deliver petitions calling for the closing of the Army School of the Americas, what they call the School of Assassins, were arrested yesterday after defying police orders and entering Fort Benning. The demonstrators, including priests, nuns, veterans, and students, marched for 2 miles carrying 8 cardboard coffins filled with the petitions. The school's headquarters is just inside the post. Most of the 600 people arrested were charged with trespassing and were released last night. But Father Roy Bourgeois, founder of the protest group SOA Watch, was arrested for violating an order stemming from an earlier protest excluding him from the post and will probably receive a prison sentence. This news from South Africa. Former South African President P.W. Botha says he will refuse to respond to a subpoena from the panel investigating apartheid-era crimes. This according to a newspaper yesterday. The Afrikaners as a people do not confess their wrongs in public. This according to Afrikaans language newspaper Report, quoting Botha as saying. He said, take me to court and charge me if you want to, but I will not personally appear before the Truth Reconciliation Commission. The pronouncement put Botha on a collision course with the panel and its head, former Archbishop Desmond Tutu, the Nobel laureate. Failure to appear at the hearing, tentatively scheduled for early December near Botha's retirement home in Wilderness, would result in a fine or imprisonment. Also in South Africa, Winnie Mandela, gearing up to fight for the deputy presidency of the African National Congress, says the ruling party is failing to address the concerns of the masses. The former wife of President Nelson Mandela told the Daily Johannesburg Star in a rare interview published today, "If my people want me to be deputy president, I will be deputy president." She said, "I have never pretended to speak for anybody else other than the masses, the disadvantaged, because that is where I come from." To the discomfort of the leadership, Mandela will stand for the position of ANC deputy president at the party's 50th annual conference next month, when Mandela is due to hand over the party presidency to deputy president Thabo Mbeki. China's most prominent dissident may be released from a Detroit hospital as early as today. Chinese officials abruptly freed Wei Jingsheng from prison this weekend so he could come to the United States for treatment. Wei suffers from heart problems, high blood pressure, and other ailments that worsened during his time in prison. He is listed in fair and stable condition at Henry Ford Hospital. The 47-year-old pro-democracy activist had been in jail virtually every day for the past 18 years. Wei's release came just 2 weeks after Chinese President Jiang Zemin visited the United States. Beijing earlier denied speculation it would release dissidents as a goodwill gesture. The group Human Rights Watch says it welcomes Wei's release, but says it doesn't signal a major improvement in Chinese human rights. Meanwhile, an exiled Chinese dissident, Han Dongfeng, and human rights groups today describe Beijing's release of the father of China's modern democracy movement as a cynical trade-off and just another violation of Wei Jingsheng's rights. Han Dongfeng said, "It's just another style of control. It's just a change of style." Han Dongfeng is now exiled in Hong Kong, and he told this to Reuters in an interview. The Justice Department's Inspector General will investigate why the FBI overlooked information on possible Chinese efforts to buy political influence in U.S. elections. Attorney General Janet Reno and FBI Director Louis Freeh in a joint statement Friday said the internal probe will investigate why the information was not properly transmitted within the FBI and to review the process for sharing counterintelligence information. And the investigation of Interior Secretary Bruce Babbitt's handling of an Indian casino license appears likely to result in the appointment of an independent counsel. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Iraqi President Saddam Hussein met with his cabinet yesterday and stressed that Iraq does not seek conflict with the United States. He expressed hope that a solution to the crisis involving UN weapons inspectors could be worked out. Iraq has opposed American members of the UN team, charging that they are biased. Despite the cool rhetoric, President Hussein did not, however, signal any willingness to compromise, and Iraqi officials cautioned citizens to prepare for a possible U.S. air attack. The controversy over the UN inspections teams is important because the UN must certify that Iraq has dismantled its major biological, chemical, and nuclear weapons before a punishing international embargo against Iraq is lifted. At that point, Iraq can re-enter the world oil market. Although the sanctions stop most of the oil out of Iraq, they've also devastated the country. We're now joined by Dr. Asad Bakir. He's an internist and kidney specialist at Cook County Hospital in Chicago. He's a Chicago board member of the Arab American Anti-Discrimination Committee as well. And we welcome you to Democracy Now!
Thank you.
Well, can you describe exactly what the effects of the embargo are in Iraq?
Well, the effects of the embargo have been devastating in the sense that many people, almost 750,000 children and another 750,000 adults have really died from lack of medicines, nutrition, and generally, you know, the collapse of the public health infrastructure. And this has been a direct consequence of the sanctions. So, in other words, although the shooting war ended many years ago and there was a ceasefire, there has really been, if you like, a silent war against the civilian population. And this is really in contradiction to the Geneva Convention. In other words, political ends should not be sought through punishment of the civilian population, not in war and not in peace. And unfortunately, what happened is that because of the crumbling of much of the infrastructure for public health and sanitation during the war and the destruction of many factories that used to manufacture medicines, infant formula, what have you, Iraq has not been able to reconstruct this, and there has been this phenomenal mortality rate among children, especially children under 5 years old.
What are the numbers that we're talking about?
Well, we are talking about, and these may be old numbers, we are talking about 570,000 children, and this was these were the statistics from about a year ago, and at least as many adults. And these are numbers that are not, by the way, these are not numbers from Iraqi sources or, you know, interested parties. These are numbers from United Nations publications and memoranda that have come over the years since 1991. So the situation really there is desperate, and I don't know if people have a clear picture of what's happening there. I mean, reports have come out, you know, occasionally in the Wall Street Journal and the Chicago Tribune, and, you know, even on network channels and CNN. But to actually grasp the immensity of the disaster that's going on in Iraq now, I think people really need to go to the country and see for themselves. I mean, you essentially, you know, you look at the public hospitals in Iraq, and there is nothing. There are no antibiotics, no intravenous fluids. You have surgery. Doctors do surgery without a prior X-rays, without the sterile gloves, without anesthesia. You know, people go to the hospitals. Women take their children to the hospitals essentially to die. The hospitals are dirty. They are infested with insects. Children play out in the streets, and streets that are flooded with sewage. You know, when they cross from one side of the street to the other, you know, they are wading through sewage. Then they get these diarrheal diseases, you know, and because there is a lack of intravenous fluids and antibiotics, and because they are nutritionally compromised to start with, you know, they are dying very fast. I mean, it doesn't take too much diarrhea to kill a child that's under 5 years old. So the situation and many items are embargoed. It goes beyond the, you know, military items. Many more items that are perceived to have dual use are embargoed. There's a shortage, for instance, of pencils because graphite is seen to have a dual use. There's a shortage of drugs like nitroglycerin that are used for, you know, angina, for coronary artery disease, because nitroglycerin is perceived to have dual use because you can make TNT, you can make dynamite from nitroglycerin, and so on and so forth. And, so there is really a general lack of almost everything that is essential to everyday life, you know, in a modern age. And this has not happened in a country that was very poor to start with, you know, a country like sub-Saharan Africa or Bangladesh. This happened in a country that was affluent, that was probably the most affluent of any other Arab countries, the Arab countries with large populations, that had a large middle class, and so on. So the population really has not had the wherewithal to adjust, you know, to this catastrophe. And that had, you know, that had made it doubly painful.
Dr. Asad Bakir is who we're talking to right now, internist and kidney specialist at Cook County Hospital in Chicago, and a board member of the Arab American Anti-Discrimination Committee, which is based in Washington, D.C. Why do you think the embargo has been imposed and has never been lifted for the past 6.5 years? I was listening to the deputy foreign minister of Iraq, Tariq Aziz, over the last few days, and he was saying, in defense of Saddam Hussein, that there have been 700 inspection situations, you know, in events, whatever, over the last years that they have, where they have allowed in inspectors, that there are a few times that they haven't. And now it's not that they don't want the inspections, but they don't want as many U.S. inspectors as there are. Now, apparently, they're asking for proportionate representation from the U.N. Security Council on the inspection team of people from different countries. But he says that there's a moving target for the sanctions to be lifted, and that, yes, that perhaps there was a provoking by Iraq to try to get the sanctions lifted. Can you explain what you think, as an Iraqi-American, from your perspective, why you think these sanctions have never been lifted?
Well, I'm not sure, because, it should not be very difficult, you know, to confirm that a country is complying with, you know, with certain things that it had agreed to do. The issue of the sanctions, really, I mean, obviously the sanctions have been kept in an attempt to disarm Iraq. But that whole issue, you know, should be separated from the humanitarian issue, which is the suffering population. I mean, we have to make a distinction between these two. You know, the sanctions, you know, sanctions against innocent populations to attain political means are not legal. They are not ethical. They are not humane. Sanctions have been tried in the past and have not worked. You know, they have only hurt the civilian population. So I think we have to make that distinction. And even the sanctions themselves, you know, you cannot include everything, almost everything, under this blanket of sanctions. You know, there has to be a distinction between what is significantly military or has military use, and what is needed, you know, for the population, you know, and to build up the infrastructure for public health and sanitation. You know, you look at now, you know, I mean, even when there was an easing of the sanctions, you know, the so-called oil for food deal, you know, that had lulled people into a false sense of relief, you know, that things were going to get better for the people of Iraq. Well, you know, that's really not the situation, because when you think about it, you know, and this has been calculated, you see that what will trickle down to the average Iraqi citizen from this oil for food deal is really 25 cents, because you are talking about payment of reparations, payment of interest on loans, you know, payment for the work that the United Nations did, you know, to dismantle the weapon system and so on and so forth. So, you know, that's not going to be enough. I mean, Iraq, you know, would have to go back to, producing more oil, so that, you know, you have enough money, you know, to repair these, you know, agricultural machinery, to buy fertilizers, to repair the pumping stations, you know, for sewage, you know, the whole infrastructure for sanitation and public health, the schools, you know, the factories that used to make food, and so on and so forth. So I think there has to be a distinction, you know, between these two issues. And, you know, as I said, you know, sanctions against civilian populations are really not allowed. They are, you know, they are illegal in wartime as well as in peacetime. And what's happened is that I think there is a general insensitivity as to what's happening to the people of Iraq. You know, there was some time back, there was on 60 Minutes, Leslie Stahl asked Mrs. Albright, Madeleine Albright, who was our UN representative at the time, and she said, "Mrs. Albright, 570,000 Iraqi children have died since the ceasefire, and that's more than died in Hiroshima. Do you think this is a worthwhile price to pay?" And Mrs. Albright, after a brief hesitation, said, "Yes, I think so." Now, you know, I want to ask you, if Mrs. Albright has said that about any other children anywhere else in the world, but specifically, let's say, about children in the West or in North America, wouldn't there have been a tremendous uproar? She would have probably had to resign, you know. But none of this happened. You know, it's as though children in Iraq are not children, or it's as though they are not human. Nothing happened, you know. In fact, Mrs. Albright was promoted to, you know, to become Secretary of State. So I'm saying what I see here, you know, and I hope I am wrong, what I see here really is a concept of racism, in the sense that Iraqi lives don't matter.
Dr. Assad Bakir, we only have 20 seconds. Are you concerned about Saddam Hussein's use of nerve gas and being able to develop it now, what the United States is saying, his attempts now not to be inspected so that he can't develop it further?
Well, you know, I really don't know the facts about this. As you know, this whole development has been recent. You know, I'm not there. I don't know. But, you know, this whole business, I mean, there has to be a different arrangement vis-a-vis Iraq. Because, you know, you cannot really, if someone wants to produce nerve gas or germs, you know, what have you, you cannot, it is almost impossible to prevent that. You know, because you can do that in a garage, you know. You can do it in a small storage room. You know, so this whole political structure, you know, has to change. This matter is being you know, approached in a very amateurish, you know, short-sighted way. You know, and there has to be, you know, something else needs to happen in terms of a political settlement or dialogue to that whole situation.
On that note, I want to thank you very much for being with us again, Dr. Asad Bakir, internist and kidney specialist at Cook County Hospital in Chicago, a member of the board of the Arab American Anti-Discrimination Committee. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! When we come back, we'll be joined by Congressmember John Conyers. We'll talk with him about a number of issues, ask him what he thinks about what's going on in Iraq, but we'll focus on police brutality hearings that he'll be holding in New York tomorrow. At the end of the show, we're going to look at a stalking study that took place and was released last week. It says that in a woman's lifetime, there's a 1 in 12 chance that she will be stalked. You're listening to Pacific Radio's Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. We're joined in the studio now by Congressmember John Conyers. Representative Conyers is from Michigan's 14th Congressional District. He's co-founder and senior member of the Congressional Black Caucus. In 1996, was re-elected to his 17th term in the U.S. House of Representatives and is currently holding the distinction of being the longest-serving African-American in the history of the U.S. House of Representatives. And he's waving his finger at me right now. What did I get wrong?
Have you heard of the Fifth Amendment?
He is the senior Democrat of the House Committee on the Judiciary and is in New York to hold hearings on police brutality tomorrow. But before we go to that issue, Congressmember Conyers, we've just been talking about Iraq, and I do want to ask you what your views are on what the United States is doing right now, as well as what Saddam Hussein is doing. Defense Secretary William Cohen said yesterday, Iraq in recent years has possessed enough chemical and biological agents to kill millions of people, and warned that the Baghdad regime could quickly reconstitute its mass weapons programs if UN inspectors are not allowed to resume their work soon. And the drumbeat for war is building.
Well, two incidents occur. One right a few moments ago, I came up the elevator to the 19th floor, and there was a lady talking to the fellow that directs everyone down there, and she said, you know, we should really bump him off. I presume she was talking about the head of the Iraq government. and she saw me looking down at my shoes, and she said, you don't agree with that. I said, I'm nonviolent. She said, so am I. I said, well, what about our philosophy then? She said, well, that's what, after we get rid of these guys, then we can be nonviolent. The other unrelated incident was in the cloakroom on the last day of the first session of the 105th Congress, in which members were saying, oh, goodness, this is going to cost Saddam Hussein big that President Clinton lost the fast-track vote. Because the wimp psychology kicks in here for presidents. You got to show you're tough. I mean, after you get your brains beat out by your own party and your own members, can you imagine a situation where the President of the United States, the Speaker of the House, big business, the whole cabinet can't get 218 votes out of the House. So Saddam is in big trouble.
You've got a whole window here. It's not just this moment in November, because we're going to go right through to, when is it, May, when the Paula Jones trial takes place. You've got a whole window where you want to divert it, where President Clinton will want to divert attention away from what's going on here at home.
Now, remember, during the oil war, as it's called, General Schwarzkopf wanted to go right in and pick Saddam Hussein out and end this blight once and for all. General Colin Powell, chief of staff, said no. And Hussein was spared, not because Colin Powell is a more gentle chief of staff, but because world opinion would not sanction the U.S. doing it. World opinion now restrains a number of people in Washington, D.C., for doing to Saddam Hussein what they would really like to do, because most of our allies are saying, hey, guys, take it easy, would you please? Do we have to go to war about everything that we disagree with?
So what do you think should be the course right now of action?
Well, I'm not sure. We could try... what I'd like to see happen is this. It hurts me to know that 250,000 kids are being killed or dying in Iraq because of poisoning, no food, no health facilities, because of our embargo and sanctions against Iraq. So, what do we want to do? We don't want to punish the people because we dislike its leader. And that, in effect, is what our policy always turns out. We bomb the living bejesus out of Iraq, but Hussein always escapes. So if you're talking about piling more and more punishment upon a people who, for all I know, may be as... disabused of him as we are, what does that prove?
Are you concerned that this is all happening as Congress has now gone out on break until next year, that this could happen when Congress isn't even in session, possibly a bombing of Iraq?
Well, Congresses come and go. What difference does it make with some of these Congresses, whether they're in or out? The president does what he wants anyway.
Congressmember John Conyers is with us. I want to move from this issue, we have a number of issues to talk about with you, to one that took place over the weekend, an ongoing story, before we talk about the police brutality hearings. Over the summer on Democracy Now!, reporter Katie Ornstein broke a story exposing the whereabouts of a death squad leader accused of committing crimes against humanity. Emmanuel Constant, the head of the Haitian death squad FRAP, which human rights groups say was responsible for many of the violent acts committed during the three-year military dictatorship of General Raoul Cedras in Haiti, is currently wanted on charges of arson, torture, and murder in Haiti. But as we reported on Democracy Now!, he's been living perfectly legally in New York City, in the borough of Queens, for 2 years under a secret deal that he struck with the U.S. government. He previously worked for the Central Intelligence Agency in Haiti. Now human rights groups and congressional leaders have mounted a campaign to demand that Constant be extradited to Haiti to face criminal charges. And this past weekend, on Saturday, there was a protest held in front of Emmanuel Constant's house.
But the terror continues in Haiti. The oppression continues in Haiti, even though the democracy, the embryonic democracy, is struggling to breathe. It cannot in part breathe freely and fully because of organizations like FRAP.
That's Ron Daniels, executive director of the Center for Constitutional Rights, a human rights law firm based in New York City. He is also joining us in the studio with Congressmember John Conyers. He was speaking Saturday at the protest just before people marched from the train station in Laurelton, a section of Queens where Emmanuel Constant lives, to his house. And as they marched, they chanted,
Let's go! Let's go! Let's go!
They're chanting, Toto must go. Toto, the nickname for Emmanuel Constant. When they arrived at the house, they laid a wreath on Emmanuel Constant's front lawn to remember the number of people who were killed, between 3,000 and 5,000 people during the coup. And after the protests left, the protesters left, I had a chance to talk to a neighbor of Emmanuel Constant. His name was Jean-Claude Etienne. What do you think of Emmanuel Constant being your neighbor?
Oh, bah, moi, ça rien, puisque nous avons fait une pétition, nous avons écrit plusieurs congrès américains, nous tout haïtiens signés, nous n'avons jamais fait aucun rien.
What can I say? I don't think anything about it. We've made a couple of petitions written to congressmen, they haven't done anything yet.
Do you think he should be living freely in the United States?
Bon, enfin, c'est un monde qui fait crime, il fait pour le payer crime, il fait pour retourner en Haïti, pour aller juger, pour tout le monde y tuer.
I think that a man who's committed crimes should be judged for his crimes and sent back to Haiti where he can pay for the crimes that he committed.
Why do you think the U.S. doesn't extradite him to Haiti?
Bon, États-Unis pas besoin de faire extradition de Toto Constant parce que Toto Constant son agent CIA. Si Toto Constant est jugé en Haïti, un pile bagaille américain va devoir sortir de là pour le sortir, pour le connaître le secret. Et États-Unis cap qu'aime tout gouvernement dictatorial dans le monde entier.
The United States will never extradite Constant because he was an agent of the CIA, and if he was sent back to Haiti and put on trial, a lot of secrets would come out, a lot of things about the American government would be revealed.
Dictateur, mon cap oppressé mon.
About the dictators who oppress people.
Yeah.
Were you surprised to learn you'd be living next to him?
No.
Pas saisi.
No. Non, pour moi, son bail est normal parce que les Américains aiment ça. Ils aiment dictateurs.
Because the Americans love dictators.
And that is the neighbor of Emmanuel Constant. His name, Jean-Claude Etienne, says that they have petitioned Congress that he should be extradited, as the Haitian government has requested that Emmanuel Constant should be extradited to Haiti. Congressmember John Conyers and Ron Daniels are with us. Ron Daniels, executive director of the Center for Constitutional Rights, who you just heard speaking through the bullhorn, also former presidential candidate with the Campaign for a New Tomorrow. John Conyers, what does that make you feel like when you hear him say America loves dictators?
Well, it makes me realize that he was generally correct, but technically incorrect. Some American leaders love dictators. Americans don't love dictators. I could almost produce a poll for you to show that. But the larger question, though, is what do we do with him? And here we run into some problems. The big problem is that we haven't got the judicial system set up in Haiti to handle a case of this magnitude. So while I want justice served, I don't want justice disserved by ridding this neighbor of a former agent and person accused of the most heinous offenses.
But should he be free to walk the streets of this country?
No.
Ron Daniels, this is an issue.
But I need some legal ground now that I've said no real quickly and agreed with you. Then the next question is, on what theory of law do we incarcerate a person but not send them back to the country where the crimes are committed?
Ron Daniels, and you're with the Center for Constitutional Rights. On what grounds?
And I think herein lies the bind. See, the fact of the matter is we cannot take the position that the European colonial powers took towards Africa and other countries when they said that you're not ready for independence, you're not ready for democracy. The fact of the matter is Haiti is a sovereign nation. We may, in fact, have some information about the readiness or unreadiness of its judicial system, but they have, in fact, requested, I think, on two or three, at least two occasions, that Emmanuel Constant be extradited back to Haiti. So our task is not to second guess. Our task is not to make contingency plans for what the Haitian people want or should want or what their system is about. The United States has found ways and means of securing people when it felt it necessary, whether it was to swoop down illegally and to scoop up Noriega, or to recently hold incarceration for several months Patrick Ely, who is the former chief of security for President Aristide. And so, no, he should not be walking the streets of New York. He is, by the definition of the State Department, a terrorist. They have defined him as such. And the laws of the United States are not supposed to, in fact, protect persecutors. It is supposed to protect those fleeing persecution. So there are grounds, it seems to me, for his detention. He is not being detained for fear that he will, in fact, tell all in relationship to his relationship to the Central Intelligence Agency and what they did. So our posture, again, is not to be apologists, but to clearly and forcefully fight for the extradition of Emmanuel Constant. Now, if we don't achieve that, it is still the process. We have to ask ourselves, what are the principles and values of this country? And we have to live up to those. We have to fight for that. And so we can't sort of predict the outcome. Our vision and values is validated in the struggle to do the right thing. And that's why we're pressing the campaign. That's why we're pushing to have Constant extradited back to Haiti.
You know, that's what happens when you work with a building full of lawyers. I mean, you evade the question so skillfully that you forget that it was not answered. We both agree on almost everything except returning him back. Now, I'll be talking to the president of Haiti very shortly.
René Préval.
Exactly. And if they want him back, I will be able to end this division between myself and Ron, this very small, tiny division, and I will urge that we extradite him. But the question is, how do you hold a person here if... Oh, that's right. His answer was, we don't. We don't second-guess an independent nation. Well, then I will let Ron Daniels represent my position when he walks in Haiti. He's brought before... We get him out of this fellow's neighborhood, and we send him back in chains. We bring him up before the Haitian Department of Justice. Constant brings in, well, I say five lawyers, but one lawyer will do, and under the Haitian judicial system, he will be released. And there, you may never, number one, you may never see him again, but number two, he may be released to create way more problem in Haiti than he could ever create in a New York neighborhood.
Central question is, should the United States of America harbor human rights abusers, torturers, and death squad leaders? The answer to that question is no.
Well, one of the things that reporter Katie Ornstein revealed when she was on Democracy Now! A few months ago, who exposed exactly where Emmanuel Constant is living in Queens, New York. It was not known even if he was exactly living in New York, though suspected, and he was seen at discotheques and nightclubs, etc., in New York, was the secret deal that was made between the U.S. government and Emmanuel Constant upon his release from the detention center. And among the provisions in that deal were that Emmanuel Constant would not speak out publicly, make pronouncements about Haiti or what he had done in Haiti. The U.S. government was saying this to him. What do you make of this, Congressmember Conyers?
Well, I make of this that he should be a subject for an interview on your program.
Then we have the grounds, huh?
Under your skill, and have Daniels here, too, and this guy will have blown that
to protect
deal.
Me or to help in the question?
To help in the question. See, he can ask questions that are so loaded but so innocent-sounding that... Constant will probably be freely... and I understand that he comes pretty close to doing that even now.
And the other question with the Haitian judicial system is that they don't yet have the FRAP documents that the U.S. government troops procured when they went into Haiti, tens of thousands of them, that talk about just who was involved with the killings. And while the U.S. government said, when I was in Haiti, they were saying they were going to make them available imminently, it has been now years, and the Haitian government has not received these documents that would lay out exactly what happened in Haiti during the coup.
And I think there must be massive pressure. This is my point. I mean, we can always find ways and means in the the rationale for various things. But our task, it seems to me, on the progressive side, is to press the point.
Yes.
And the Center for Constitutional Rights has requested these documents. We've received few of them. They've been heavily deducted. And, again, the sovereign nation of Haiti has a right to these documents.
No question.
And we could also say, well, if they got them, they might be shredded or they might wash down the toilet bowl or something. But that's not the point. The point is they are a sovereign government and entitled to the documents that they should have.
We have to break, but when we come back, and I know that both of you have to leave to go to the Center for Constitutional Rights, I want to ask you briefly about the hearings that will be held tomorrow at Medgar Evers College in Brooklyn, New York, on police brutality that Congressmember John Conyers will be holding. And then finally today, we'll talk about the stalking study that's out. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, and we'll be back in a minute. This is Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, heard from Hawaii to Maine, from Washington State to Florida, California to New York, and a lot of cities in between. I'm Amy Goodman, and we are still joined by Michigan Congressmember John Conyers, co-founder and senior member of the Congressional Black Caucus and senior Democrat on the House Committee on the Judiciary. We're also joined by Ron Daniels, who is executive director of the Center for Constitutional Rights, a human rights law firm based in New York City, ran for president in 1992 on the ticket of the Campaign for a New Tomorrow. Now, you're both working on hearings that are taking place tomorrow in New York City. I know the Center for Constitutional Rights is hoping that they will take place around the country after New York City tomorrow. But Congressmember Conyers, tell us what you expect to hear tomorrow.
Well, there have been so many cases of police misconduct, violence, and everything else in between, corruption, that we are constrained to hold hearings here before the end of the year. In September, the Congressional Black Caucus had their conference in Washington, and several hundred New Yorkers came down petitioning me and my colleagues. I was chairing the Criminal Justice Brain Trust that we got to get up here fast. And That helped stimulate our interest and responsibility to come here.
And this was soon after the beating of Abner Louima,
yes,
what many call the police torture of Abner Louima,
exactly,
the Haitian immigrant who was hurt by police in New York City.
So what we're trying to do is hold a reasoned, thorough, balanced hearing that includes, first of all, the victims. And thanks to Ron Daniels and the center, we've worked out a way that a person would be able to let his complaint or grievance be known, even if he or she may not end up on this long list of people that are going to testify. Secondly, is that this is a deeper problem, a problem so deep that we really have to bring in public officials. And I'm asking publicly on your show for the Honorable Mayor Giuliani to be present with us as we try to learn and talk our way out of this situation. Otherwise, we've got a donut with a hole in it.
Have you asked to meet with him, or have you asked for his presence at
yes,
tomorrow's hearing?
Absolutely.
And what has been his response?
We haven't gotten one yet. So keeping hope alive. Maybe he'll, when he's listening to the Amy Goodman show, say, well, you know, Conyers has a point.
It might have more meaning to him if we say Democracy Now! Ron Daniels, this is a beginning tomorrow in New York City that you're hoping to see around the country.
Well, first of all, let me just say that this has been an extraordinary process because we began to galvanize this issue back in April when the Center for Constitutional Rights, in conjunction with WBAI and a number of other public interest legal institutions and advocacy groups, had a national emergency conference at Hunter College. Some 800 people, 750 cities, 16 states were there. And then we went on to Washington, D.C., and the congressman was kind enough to have a hearing there and to then hold this one that's coming up tomorrow. So we think that this is a good process that's underway of galvanizing grassroots constituencies and people across the board all over the country. And we are hopeful that out of this this hearing, this select session on police brutality and misconduct, that other sessions will be held across the country. Now, whether it's in South Carolina, whether it's Minnesota, Buffalo, all over the country, this is a problem of deep dimensions. And we think that some incremental progress can be made on certain key issues. For example, the Justice Department ought to be collecting data on this phenomenon. They're not doing that currently. Janet Reno should be issuing an annual report on the use of deadly force. That has not been the case. So that we think that this kind of select session on police brutality and misconduct can be an effective way of galvanizing public sentiment.
Congressmember John Conyers, do you think that we'll ever see a hearing like this take place actually on the Hill?
Yes. As soon as I become the chairman of the Judiciary Committee in the House.
Have you had any discussions with the Republicans about holding a hearing on police brutality on Capitol Hill? And has there ever been such a hearing?
Yes. I've held hearings on police brutality on Capitol Hill. More than once. And I've done this. You have to realize how politics rears its ugly head in all subjects. The chairman of the full committee, with whom I have a good relationship, Henry Hyde, has allowed this much to happen. The subcommittee chairman of the subcommittee on crimes chairman, Mr. Bill McCollum of Florida, has not objected, and we're working on this, but we don't have any enthusiasm for it. We do have promises, though, that there will be hearings, that this may have triggered the possibility of more hearings occurring in Washington and around the country next year.
I want to thank you both very much for joining us. If people from around the country would like to hold hearings in their city around police brutality, where you, as the senior Democrat on the House Judiciary Committee, come to take testimony, where can they call?
Well, I think that they should call the Center for Constitutional Rights at 1-800-764-0235.
One more time?
1-800-764-0235. But not only with their request for hearings, but also complaints. We want to know from all across the country what is happening in their respective cities, who are the coalitional forces, what are the organizations that are working on this issue, so that we can bring it all together. And then when we take that to Congressman Conyers, then we have a good leg to stand on.
Well, I want to thank you again for joining us today. Again, Michigan Congressmember John Conyers from Michigan's 14th Congressional District, co-founder and senior member of the Congressional Black Caucus, senior Democrat of the House Judiciary Committee in New York for tomorrow's police brutality hearings that will be taking place at Medgar Evers College in Brooklyn. It's appropriate, I think, to be taking place at a college named for the civil rights leader slain by a leader of the Ku Klux Klan in Mississippi. And we've also been joined by Ron Daniels, executive director of the Center for Constitutional Rights, a human rights law firm based in New York City, and former presidential candidate. Will you be running again?
Well, I don't think
Don't
so.
Answer that. As your attorney.
Perhaps I should have asked you, Congressmember Conyers, if you will be running for a higher office.
Daniel, tell her not to don't let me answer that either.
We tried that in 1976, actually. You may not recall. We did try to promote him for president in 1976.
Well, we'll be the first to let people know what possibly your plans are, Congressmember Conyers and Ron Daniels. Thanks for being with us. And we're going to move on to another issue of brutality right now. A stunning new report out shows that stalking is far more common than previously thought. According to a national survey of both men and women, more than 1 million women are stalked every year in the United States, and one out of every 12 women will be stalked at some time in our lives. Dr. Patricia Jaden joins us right now. She's the principal investigator of study and research associate at the Center for Policy Research, which is a nonprofit research organization based in Denver, Colorado. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Dr. Jaden.
Hello, Amy.
Can you tell us what you found exactly in this study?
Well, what we did, I think I'll step back and explain a little what we did, and that is that we interviewed by telephone a nationally representative sample of 8,000 men and 8,000 women. And we asked them questions about their experiences with violence, including stalking, but we also asked them about their experiences with forcible rape, physical assault, emotional abuse, their fear of crime. And then, in addition, we asked them about whether or not that they had experienced repeated following, harassing activities such as lying in wait, surveillance, non-consensual communication, telephone harassment, and vandalism. And if they said that they had experienced these things repeatedly by one or more persons, then we asked them how much fear that behavior caused them to feel. And if they said that they felt extremely frightened or they felt that their perpetrator would seriously harm or kill them or someone close to them, then we counted them as a stalking victim. And I mention this because I think it's important to know that our estimates are conservative, and they're based on a very high standard of fear. In other words, for a person to have been counted as a stalking victim, again, they had to have been extremely frightened by their behavior, not just harassed or annoyed or somehow distressed. So,
can you explain exactly what you mean by stalking?
Well, that's what I'm saying. We did not because there is so much confusion today, both legally and I think in the public's mind about what stalking means. We didn't come out and say, "Have you ever been stalked?" Instead, what we did is we asked the men and women that we interviewed whether they had ever had people follow or spy on them, send them, you know, unsolicited letters, written correspondence, whether anybody had ever stood outside their home or school or place of work, whether they had ever vandalized their property. We used what are called behaviorally specific cues to get the respondent to disclose any possible type of victimization they might have had. Our own personal definition, our definition of stalking, conformed to the definition of stalking that has been developed by the federal government under a project that they called the Model Anti-Stalking Code, which they developed to help states pass uniform laws against stalking throughout the country. And what the federal government has recommended in terms of the definition is that stalking be defined as, the willful, malicious, repeated following, harassing of another person that would cause a reasonable person to feel extreme fear. A person doesn't have to have a direct threat of violence made against them to feel fear, according to the federal definition of violence, and that's the same definition of stalking, and that's the same definition of stalking that we used.
Dr. Jaden, Ms. Magazine, this month's issue, talks about the fact that while crime is down in this country, that the rate of rape has not decreased as quickly as general crime in the country.
Mm-hmm.
How does that tie in?
Well, we did find that If you want to put our findings in context, in other words, the figures that you gave earlier, that 1 million women will be stalked every year in America, if you look at rape, what it compares to is that women are at about a 3 times greater likelihood of being raped than stalked. Of being stalked than raped, excuse me. So they're at far greater risk of being stalked than raped. However, if you look at physical assaults, women are twice as likely to be physically assaulted as stalked. So that gives you some kind of context in which to put these figures. One of the, I think, stunning findings of our study, and one that I think I was most concerned about, is the very, very strong link that we found between partner stalking and partner violence. Most of the women, over 50% of the women, about two-thirds of the women who reported that they had been stalking victims, had been stalked by an intimate partner, and that may have been a current or former husband, a current or former live-in partner, or a date or boyfriend. What we found is the women who said that they had been stalked by their husbands or their cohabiting partners, that in 80% of those cases, they had also been physically assaulted by that same partner, and in 30% of the cases, they had been raped, forcibly raped by that partner. So we just found an incredibly strong link between partner stalking and partner violence, and I think that finding suggests that we really need to take these cases obviously very seriously, because they oftentimes will either have had violence they either will lead to violence, or violence will also have been a part of the constellation, if you will, of behaviors that these women have experienced.
Dr. Jaden, this part of the information that you've gathered, the stalking data, is part of a larger national violence against women survey being prepared by your center, by the Center for Policy Research. Now, you work with the Justice Department?
This project was funded jointly by the Justice Department through the National Institute of Justice, and also by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services through the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. And so we are working with both agencies to conduct this project. Actually, the conduct of the project, in other words, the interviews have obviously been completed, and now we're simply in the analysis stage.
And what will the Justice Department and your center do with this information?
Well, we have we will be writing, and the Justice Department and the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention will be disseminating a series of standalone pieces on various parts of the survey. The first one to come out is on stalking, and the reason that we focused on stalking is because this is a groundbreaking study. It's the first ever national study on the prevalence of stalking. We literally had no idea what we would find, and so we prioritized our analysis of the stalking data and in-depth report on our findings will be released by the Department of Justice, I believe, and the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention in February.
If someone is being stalked, what do you recommend that they do?
Well, I definitely recommend that they call the police. I think that partly because of this study, but also because of the raised consciousness, you know, in the past 10 years, the passage of anti-stalking laws in every state across the nation, police are aware now that this is a serious problem and that it needs to be treated seriously. And so I think that that obviously is a very first step.
And if people want to get a hold of your study, Dr. Jaden, where can they call?
They can call the Center for Policy Research at 303-837-1555.
That's 303-837-1555. Dr. Patricia Jaden, thanks so much for being with us. Principal investigator, the study done on stalking at the Center for Policy Research, funded by the Justice Department. And if you'd like a copy of today's show, you can order a cassette copy by calling 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. Democracy Now! Is produced by Dan Coughlin. Leslie George is our director. Errol Maitland was our engineer. Julie Drizin is our executive producer. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!